don't frighten us by telling us the facts, 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 the facts. We must be the great arsenal of democracy. For us, this is an emergency as serious as war itself. We must apply ourselves to our task with the same resolution, the same sense of urgency, the same spirit of patriotism and sacrifice as we would show were we at war.
For 91.3 FM WVUD and WVUD HD1 Newark in the great state of Delaware, I'm Bill Humphrey, and thanks for listening. The following episode was recorded on June 5th, 2017, and produced by me at my studio in Newton, Massachusetts. This week, Nate joins me to discuss hunger crises in Yemen, South Sudan, Somalia, and Nigeria, as well as Trump's plan to privatize air traffic control. Arsenal for Democracy is available for download on Wednesdays at arsenalfordemocracy.com and from iTunes. We air the show in Delaware on 91.3 FM and stream it from WVUD.org on Wednesdays at 6 p.m. Eastern. Follow us on Twitter at AFD Radio or like us on Facebook. You're listening to Arsenal for Democracy. I'm your host, Bill Humphrey. Joining me again this week in studio is Nate. Hi, Nate. Welcome back.
Great to be here, Bill.
So there are a number of international crises that we feel are not getting enough attention. They are getting some attention in the media, but we feel that they're not necessarily getting enough attention. And so we wanted to highlight some of those. These are, conflict-related humanitarian disasters that are building up. These are things that can be avoided, they can be mitigated, and there doesn't seem to be a whole lot of energy toward fixing them. The biggest one is one that we talk about a lot on this show periodically, and that's Yemen. The ones we'll be talking about later on are going to be South Sudan, Somalia, and Northern Nigeria. But let's start with Yemen, since it is something that's come up quite a bit on the show. What is the situation in Yemen that makes it a humanitarian disaster in the making?
Yeah, so, I mean, obviously we've talked a lot about the war that's been going on there. And as a result of that, we're now seeing an increase of, for example, cholera cases. There's been a huge outbreak of cholera, especially in the past several weeks even. And there have been reports from UNICEF now over 70,000 suspected cases of cholera and several hundred outbreak deaths in the past several weeks. And they're estimating that within the next 2 weeks, it could reach 130,000 cases. And that's to go along with the fact that there's millions of Yemenis on the brink of famine. So there's about 7.3 million at the brink of famine. And I think 19 million total are food insecure. And basically about 60% of the country is food insecure. It's the largest food security crisis in the world right now.
Now, Yemen, before the war that Saudi Arabia has been inflicting on them, before that was always having a lot of problems anyway. There was not a lot of agricultural investment into food production. It was generally more lucrative to be growing non-edible narcotic crops.
Cut.
But the problem with that is that it also requires an immense amount of water to grow in general and specifically in Yemen. So they were busy draining the water table, which they also need for, you know, other food production and also just to be able to drink water to survive. So things were not great before the war. But what specifically has the Saudi-led coalition been doing that makes the food situation so much worse?
Yeah, so specifically you're talking about food imports. I believe there's a port city of Hodeidah, and I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing that right, of course, but around, I think, 90% of Yemen's food is imported. I think around 70% from that one port alone, and it's being blockaded by the Saudi Navy, and there's been airstrikes around in that area, obviously being refueled by American planes, of course, and of course through planes that we've sold to the Saudis, presumably at one point or another. So that's sort of one of the main focal points, and if that port was taken by the Saudis, it could lead to even more cascading effects. That's pretty much one of the main focal points right now. There are also, for example, fishermen who can't go out and fish for fear of being attacked by warplanes that are flying around overhead. So that's another a big part of this.
Yeah, that naval blockade has just been very brutal in general. Early on in the war, the Saudis bombed a port that had already unloaded containers, I think, from various aid organizations, probably the United Nations or Food Aid Organization. That was food that was all ready to go, and they bombed it and then came up with some excuse for why they bombed it. Also, something that we've talked about before on the radio show, but just to remind folks, or people who maybe didn't hear that episode, a lot of the Saudi targets have been key infrastructure, things of that are not really of military value. They're just of civilian value, like water pipelines.
Yeah, or just various factories that produce some food elements. So
I think there's, a few years farms. Ago, there was a like a bread factory or something that we covered that got hit by Saudi planes. And I mean, they're, you know, some of the time they're just hitting stuff because they're incompetent, but a lot of the time they are hitting stuff intentionally just to inflict massive damage. Folks may recall that my hypothesis that I've mentioned many times on the show, which I still stand by, is that Saudi Arabia, you know, their primary goal was to take over all of Yemen and install their own person who had been kind of removed by the Houthis. But their kind of backup goal, if that didn't work out immediately, you know, if they couldn't win a lightning victory, was just to break up Yemen, make it a non-viable non-state, or partition it into two parts or something like that. That most of the politicians they back are southern Yemenis. Yemen was partitioned until 1990. They have a lot of South Yemeni secession groups that they've previously armed in the past and that they were, you know, providing supplies to during this war and trying to work with, not very successfully because everyone in this is totally incompetent, except, I guess, the Houthis, who are super scrappy insurgents. You know, there was a couple years back, there were Hezbollah commanders who were quoted as saying that they had gotten their training in insurgency stuff from the Houthis several decades ago. That, you know, this is an ongoing long-term situation, but the Houthis, despite being basically emaciated at this point in many areas, probably from lack of food and supplies, are still managing to hold their own against these much better armed forces in the southern part of Yemen. But that's why these blockades don't seem to be going anywhere and seem to be intensifying at various ports and in the air.
Yeah, and if you watch some videos that are coming out from on the ground, I mean, there are aid organizations operating there, but oftentimes, you know, they'll be attacked either sometimes by Houthis, but also times by other militants. There's also Al-Qaeda operating around there. They're sort of not quite on anyone's side, but sometimes strategically align with the Saudi coalition more against the Houthis just because they have some common interest there. So,
and before the war, Al-Qaeda tended to control the very, very poor and hungry hinterlands in the sort of south, mostly eastern part of the country. They've now moved into more urban areas as a result of this war, but a lot of their sort of core turf, not overlapping with the Houthis at all, was also very poor and struggling. And I'm guessing that there's, you know, food problems there as well, though that's slightly different.
Right. So, and if you, as I was saying, if you watch some videos that do come out of Yemen, it's really heartbreaking to see just the emaciated children, people that are basically on the verge of starving to death and need to be given like nutrient-rich pastes and things like that in order for them to survive. A lot of them don't make it. A lot of them can't make it because they simply can't be evacuated to like a medical facility just because of the risk of attacks and things like that. So that's a huge problem. And, you know, Greg obviously probably could speak better than me towards a lot of the health elements, global health elements to this. But, you know, when you talk about cholera, it leads to situations where children are much more likely to die if they're malnourished already. And they're
fundamentally dehydrated kids.
And so. It's poor sanitary conditions. There's sewage piling up. There's areas where children are dying of, say, like diarrhea and things. They can't, they just don't have simply sanitary conditions. And also, another thing that's popped up recently has been reports of children being sold off, basically, especially young girls, as brides, just because the parents can get more money as a result of that. There's also millions of civil servants who haven't been paid in months, and that leads to worsening economic situations because maybe that government job was supporting large families, and that could lead, so it says 8 million people are being affected by that, with only 1 million civil servants who haven't been paid. So the UN is calling for about $2.1 billion required to combat hunger and disease in Yemen alone. And so, yeah, we're child marriage alarmingly widespread. So now after the conflict, it's 72% of girls are married before age 18 compared to 50% before the conflict. And now after the conflict started, 44% of girls were reported married under age 15. So we're seeing this growing
trend. People
are
selling their children to try to get enough food. And, you know, even if these kids survive these horrible conditions and the war is brought to an end, it's this, a lot of this is utterly irreversible, unfortunately. Stunting, you know, because Greg's not here, but he would back me up on this. From a public health perspective, childhood stunted development from malnourishment and lack of food, hunger in general. It does not just limit their physical size. It also causes serious cognitive impairments that last permanently. Even just from like a really sort of brutally utilitarian economic standpoint, like you can track in studies that childhood undernourishment is associated with 20% lower lifetime earnings as adults. So, and that's like in places where they can go on to, you know, make earnings at all. And so it's just, you know, very much irreversible consequences. Now, it's somewhat worth noting that there are 154 million children around the world who suffer from this, you know.
Including a lot here.
There are unfortunately many kids with these challenges in the United States as well. You know, not certainly as many in many developing nations, but there should be none here. But, you know, 154 million children, it's a lot less than it used to be in the past, but that's generally related to structural poverty issues, which are also preventable. But this, a lot of this in Yemen is really just related to this unrelenting siege by the Saudis that has no point and no sort of strategic accomplishment on the horizon, is not going anywhere, and should be stopped immediately and could be stopped immediately. It's not going to change things. And I keep reminding folks, too, that, you know, the situation in Yemen is basically probably worse in a lot of ways than the situation in Syria. It's a much larger country in terms of population. I think it's a much larger country in terms of area as well. But in population, I think they've got, you know, even pre-war population comparisons, perhaps 10 million more in Yemen. Yemen basically has about the same or slightly larger population than Saudi Arabia. And that was probably another reason why Saudi Arabia considered it to be such a threat to have this unified Yemen, even if it was extremely poor and had nothing going on for it, really, compared to Saudi Arabia. And we've got, you know, refugee crises from Yemen as well, you know, spilling over into various places, although it's hard to leave when there's this naval blockade, which is not the case with Syria. But for some reason, it just does not get anywhere near the level of attention as with Syria. There's a lot of reasons to explain that. Obviously, you can surmise some of them. A lot of it fundamentally, though, has to do with the fact that the, you know, U.S. analysts and media people decided, not really based on a whole lot, that this was some sort of proxy conflict between Saudi Arabia and Iran. Iran barely does anything to help the Houthis, and the Houthis wouldn't need their help for most of the stuff that's happening. They already have more guns than people, you know, by a lot in Yemen, way more than even in the United States, which is often kind of the next highest per capita for, you know, guns to people. Like I said, they've been in this insurgency, you know, game, so to speak, for decades. This is not really about Iran. That's a convenient excuse. This is not really about Iran. Iran has very little to do with it. But what we do know is that Saudi Arabia is there and is causing a lot of this misery.
Yeah, well, one thing the I would say the mainstream media here in the United States has done is pretty much swallowed the line now being pushed by the Trump administration, but for a very long time by the sort of permanent establishment government in this security state here in the United States, that it's Iran that is a source of all terrorism, or they're the major sponsor, or, you know, however they put, the largest sponsor of terrorism, you know, even though when we have multiple, of course, instances of terror being sponsored by maybe governments that are technically our allies there in the Middle East. We don't like to emphasize that, of course, but now that that infects the media discourse. And as you mentioned, in comparison of Syria and Yemen, one is when it's convenient, there's children who have been covered by rubble, or children who have died, or children who are tweeting out about the horrors. Those get covered extensively, but you don't really see all that many pictures of skeletal Yemeni kids just being on the news out all the time, because that's kind of inconvenient when we're refueling the warplanes that are causing that devastation.
And we're supplying the bombs when they needed new bombs because they ran out.
Yeah,
they got
a lot of bombs.
I mean, that's the thing, right? There have been moments in this war in Yemen where you had 20 million people that were on the brink of mass starvation, and the population of Syria, as I recall, before the war was only 17 million total. And so the scale is just almost unimaginable. And I guess it goes to that thing, you know, the probably apocryphal Stalin quote, which is that, you know, people have, and this is, I'm rewording how he said it for clarity, but that people can really grasp easily, like, the tragedy of one person dying, but if it's a million people or 20 million people, it's so mind-boggling that it just becomes this statistic.
Yeah,
that's what is meant by that quote, for the most part, you know, and I, who knows if he even said it, but just like that people have trouble grasping numbers on that scale. A lot of this is also just really ideological and kind of partisan, so to speak. Let's move now to South Sudan. This is a conflict that's been going since late 2013. We've alluded to it in past segments. I think we've done some past segments on it, but it has been a while since we've talked about it. 2011, the country becomes independent from Sudan through a referendum, but for a long time, most of the conflict in Sudan, other than in Darfur, had happened in the part of the country that is now South Sudan. And the northern, you know, government often basically would supply one side or the other and pit them against each other, because it's easier to control the kind of conflict if you're pitting two rebel sides against each other for power, you know, in a semi-autonomous area, rather than like having them turn against you. They become independent, they control most of the oil, so then they have to have a deal with the northern government to, you know, ship that oil out. There's a lot of investment and oversight sometimes by the Chinese and the Japanese, who are all vying for, you know, possible control of that oil and use of that oil. But in any case, those old factions that had tried to come together in 2005 even period to, you know, during the autonomy phase, 2005 to 2013, they had tried to come together, make it work, have unity governments, that kind of thing, you know, put aside their old conflicts. That really broke down in 2013. And led to some pretty rapid emergency displacements. I think there were some dramatic incidents where, like, the U.S. had to send in aircraft to recover certain people that were on the ground, you know, in emergency rescue missions. I think the Marines were involved with that. And so there were some, you know, fears that maybe this was going to escalate into some sort of a Black Hawk Down type situation, but that didn't really materialize. And then nothing really happened. Like, it just kept going. I mean, it was kind of, it's not like a super, super high level of conflict the whole time, but just kind of ongoing state of everyone being terrorized and being in refugee camps. There were massive floods that were associated with El Nino. You had refugee camps where people couldn't lie down. They had to stand to sleep because the ground was flooded. And the UN was just totally overwhelmed, which we've alluded to in previous segments talking about Mali and Central African Republic. The UN peacekeeping mission there was just totally overwhelmed at the beginning of the conflict, and that made things very difficult as well. So what do we need to know about the situation now here in 2017?
Yeah, so they declared a famine back in February, so it's already, you know, technically a famine. These other conflict areas are sort of on the brink, and they've been warning that famines could break out technically, but in South Sudan, it's already happening. It's been happening for a while. There's about 5 million people that are sort of on the brink there, where they don't know where their next food is going to be coming from, with about 100,000 people, who I guess, are classified as currently starving. And there's a lot of stories coming out about how, in lieu of being able to get a lot of these food drops, I mean, the food drops are happening from, like, World Food Program and others, but oftentimes it's only in select parts of the country, and people don't have access to be able to get to those areas. And oftentimes militias will come and ransack hospitals and steal food from people, both on the government side and on some of the rebel sides. People have been reduced to hiding in swamps and eating water lilies in order to survive, because it's somewhat safer out in the swamp because they're less likely to be terrorized by various militias. Since I guess there were some clashes in the Wau, I guess it's pronounced, in April, there was reports for aid workers reported 46% of people increased at the UN refugee camp to about 400,000 or 40,000 total, not 400,000, but with very poor conditions, as you mentioned. There's a lot of these camps where it's not nearly up to the specifications that people would want. Currently, there's about 2 million internally displaced people, with about 1.6 million having already fled the country. There's cholera, spreading outwards from the Nile there, even to far off parts of the country that aren't necessarily right near the Nile. Even some of the aid organizations like Doctors Without Borders, they've had to close their hospitals because sometimes they'll be like ransacked or looted by militias and just becoming increasingly difficult. The government oftentimes will limit the amount of aid flights that can go over or require licenses for aid workers. And I think about 82 aid workers have been killed since the beginning of the conflict, including some recently in 2017. So, you know, you just have situations where there's really very little stable environment in which that even aid distribution is possible, much less, you know, sufficient to get out to, you know, the millions of people who are currently undergoing a famine right now.
I think I'm fascinated in a bad way by how much this conflict faded from public view and even media attention. Like I said at the top, you know, certainly there is some coverage, but compared to the level of coverage from 2005 to 2011 or so, where you had certain op-ed columnists like Nick Kristof that were like trying to claim credit for creating a country, you know, or people like, you know, George Clooney or whatever, or like really pushing to get this this country independent in the first place. I don't know if maybe, you know, where'd all the celebrity attention go? Maybe they're embarrassed by how it didn't work out as they had hoped. You know, I don't know if that's what's going on there or what, but kind of that attention seems to have gone by the wayside. I find that interesting. Seems like everyone wanted to take credit for birthing this country and no one wanted to take care of raising it or whatever. There were some interesting developments along the way, like China sent peacekeepers. I had written an op-ed arguing back in, I guess it was either late 2013 or early 2014, arguing that China should send combat deployment peacekeepers or, you know, armed peacekeepers at least, as opposed to just previously all of their peacekeeping missions, which they did send a lot of people on peacekeeping missions, but previously those had all been limited to, you know, either engineering roles or medic roles. They're all, yeah, they're People's Liberation Army members, but they were all you know, in non-combat roles and not armed, and the only people that were armed were just the sort of security details from the army there to protect them. But they did end up sending peacekeepers into this conflict, which is, you know, that makes sense for them because they invested a lot of money into building oil infrastructure in Sudan and South Sudan. And they need, not only do they need stability at the production sites, they also need stability for all the pipelines across into Sudan. They need to make sure that South Sudan and Sudan don't go to war with each other again. You know, they just need to make sure that there's overall a level of stability. And maybe, I guess, they reached some sort of level of stability and that's why they haven't done more. Just seems like nobody really wanted to have ownership over the situation once it went bad. All right, well, we're going to go to a very quick break and then we're going to be talking about Somalia and Nigeria. So stick around from arsenalfordemocracy.com and WVUD. We'll be right back. You're still listening to Arsenal for Democracy. I'm your host, Bill Humphrey. Still in studio with me is Nate. We're talking so far this hour about various conflicts around the world that are producing famine or near famine conditions that we feel aren't getting enough attention so far. We've talked at this point about Yemen and South Sudan. Let's turn our attention now to Somalia, which, you know, is partly also affected by the situation in Yemen because that is basically the closest country, you know, outside of the conflict zone or the heart of the conflict zone in Yemen. You know, it's just a hop, skip, and a jump across the Red Sea and the Straits there. What is the situation in Somalia that has led us to hunger conditions again?
Right. So currently there's about 2.9 million or about 3 million on the brink of famine, and about half the population, 6.2 million, basically need, you know, severe amounts of humanitarian aid and protection. And as we were talking just a little bit earlier, Bill, there's severe drought recently over the past several years that has, you know, made it extremely difficult to grow crops, things like that, intensified a lot of these poor conditions. And also, of course, over the past probably about a decade or so, the presence of the Al-Shabaab militia that has made it increasingly difficult to transport food aid around large sections of the country, not the entire country, but in many rural areas outside of, you know, a few population centers, much more difficult to distribute this kind of food aid. And so we're seeing an outbreak, once again, of cholera, and about 20,000 cases have been reported since January. And I just want to mention, yeah, there's about 200,000-750,000 children who are facing severe malnutrition. And as I mentioned before, this can be an intensifier for things like cholera and measles. So you're about 9 times more likely to die from cholera if you have severe malnutrition. And in certain refugee camps, there's about 72% of the refugees, the households there, the families that have traveled there, they have a kid under 5. So a lot of these are very small children who are being affected, and they could face death if, you know, cholera continues. About 70% of livestock have died due to the drought. So, and I think another thing we have to focus on is in a lot of these conflicts, climate change is an intensifier and sometimes a catalyst for a lot of these conflicts. I mean, there was effects of that that happened in Syria, effects of that that happened in Yemen, and we're seeing that in Somalia now too, where increasingly arid conditions can lead to food shortages, can lead to, you know, intensified conflict over what few resources are left. So, you know, there have been times where people have been, politicians that try to bring this up are in effect mocked for not being serious enough about security issues. But even if you go to the CIA and the Pentagon, they recognize that these kind of climate conditions can intensify conflict. So, you know, this is something that we need to continue to look at going forward, especially, I guess, the rainy season in April was delayed or wasn't as rainy as it usually is. So that, you know, makes the conflict even worse. So, you know, these are the sort of things that we're looking at here. Obviously, there was a famine in 2011 in Somalia as well.
Right, I was just going to say, yeah, 250,000 people died in that one, I think.
So, I mean, obviously, Somalia has not exactly been the most stable country over the past several decades, but this is another possibly crisis point that's happening right now.
Yeah, and, you know, Al-Shabaab has, to put it mildly, a complicated relationship with the food supply issues in Somalia. You know, they are the sort of main successor group of the Islamic Courts Union that back in 2006 had tried to take over the country and nearly succeeded. And that was more, you know, Al-Shabaab is more of a conventional terrorist organization in the Al-Qaeda sense and less in the governance sense. The ICU was more of a governance organization, but over time, Shabaab sort of mutated into a governance system in its own areas of control, although that was a much smaller area. But, you know, as Nate mentioned, right, they were often blocking delivery of food aid to various countries. And you might say, well, why were they doing that? You know, what's the purpose? Like, you know, in other countries, you'll often get groups trying to control the food aid distribution for political reasons, but not, you know, blocking it outright. And essentially, Al-Shabaab had invested millions of dollars in trying to improve domestic food production locally. And I wrote about this back in March 2014 on arsenalfordemocracy.com. You know, I kind of humorously termed it going locavore. But basically, the reason that they did this and then they specifically banned the non-governmental aid organizations that were delivering food, you know, often since the 1990s, you know, every now and then. Their argument was, if you're giving out free food to everyone, then all of the local farms are going to go bankrupt, which was true, essentially. And every time a local farm went bankrupt, that was a farm that closed. No one was there to run it. And that reduced the food production in the country even more. So it meant that there was even more food insecurity and no ability to withstand any sort of famines. So their argument was, we shouldn't have free food aid deliveries in. We should be spending money on, you know, digging irrigation channels and things like that and forcing people to purchase, you know, because everyone has to purchase food, force them to purchase locally so that there's a sustainable, you know, small local economy for these farms in these areas under Al-Shabaab's control. So that was their logic anyway, you know, right. and that was what they had, you know, reported to Al Jazeera. You can argue with their logic, obviously, but I'm just like stating, you know, how they had kind of arrived at that system.
Yeah, and I guess as these droughts have intensified, that has led a lot of people to flee the countryside and move towards some of these cities, like Baidoa is one, where there was recently, I guess, 160,000 people left the countryside, headed towards that city. There were UN refugee camps in the area, and that has actually led to a spread of cholera because, you know, all these population movements, internally displaced peoples that just, you know, not as a fault of their own, but obviously because of all these complex factors, this leads to a spread of cholera, other infectious diseases, and
carrying the bug, move into tight quarters with, you know, poor sanitation.
Horrible sanitation. And there are also, as we mentioned with Al-Shabaab, there have been aid workers who have been kidnapped, killed, and that makes it, you know, further more difficult to transport around the country, or they have to travel with military escorts and things like that, and makes that more difficult. So, there's a lot of problems right there. And as we mentioned, there's been an attempt to build latrines and other types of sanitation equipment, but, you know, a lot of these refugee camps are very much improvised, so it's, you know, certainly less than sanitary conditions.
All right, why don't we talk now about Nigeria? This is a country that we talk a lot about on the show, you know, and you and I have done plenty of segments on this as well. What is the situation in Nigeria? Where in Nigeria? Because as we know, that's a very, very large country, you know, geographically, and also a huge population. It's one of the more populous countries in the world. Where are we talking about and what's going on?
Yeah, most specifically in the Borno state, which is up in the northeast part of the country. And, you know, we've talked a lot about on the show before about Boko Haram and the results of the conflict there. And this is sort of, in some ways, the after effects, as I guess the Nigerian military has pushed them back from some certain areas in the past several months and over the course of the past year or so. And now it's leading to these really difficult situations where, you know, you have 5 million people who need life-saving humanitarian aid. It's been established between June and August with millions on the brink of famine. There's the UN deputy humanitarian coordinator for Nigeria says there's about 450,000 severely malnourished children at risk of death, of things like diarrhea or malaria or other things. And so there have been a lot of Boko Haram refugees in the Nigerian military camps. So these aren't necessarily UN camps. These are controlled by the Nigerian military. And, you know, we've talked before about how there have been many young girls who have been kidnapped by Boko Haram. And now that some of them have been freed, there's also been intense suspicion from, I guess, the military over any of these young girls who have been freed. And it's, you know, creating really difficult situations for them. They have to be searched. There's a lot of distrust of these young girls. And there have also been young girls who have been coerced into becoming suicide bombers by Boko Haram and have been blowing themselves up in, you know, various cities and villages. There are all sorts of various funds that aid agencies said they needed. The aid agencies claim they've only raised about a fifth of the $1.5 billion needed. There's been a Nigerian humanitarian fund set up by the UN. Yeah, they said they've only raised about 20%. And as an approaching rainy season could happen, the Doctors Without Borders report that they're afraid of increased cholera outbreaks and deaths. So we've talked about how, you know, lack of rain can provide some dangers. Well, you can also see if you have an intense rainy season, it could lead to further spread of infectious disease as well.
And also, if all your crops get washed away, that's not much better than not having any water for them.
Right. And so you also have a lot of people who are still unreachable with aid due to the Boko Haram threat, because they're still obviously not completely gone or anything like that. And this is another thing that's popped up, as we mentioned, in Yemen. You have some families who are selling women or selling children for food because they just simply don't have the money. And that's the more attractive option to them. Also, women selling their bodies for food. This is something that we've seen happen before. So, you know, this is, even though that night Boko Haram has been beaten back a little bit, you still see, you know, the legacy and also just the intense devastation that has been a result of this conflict. And one thing that we sort of have talked about in the past, and maybe we could go a little bit more into it, is just the result of this, the conflict and the way it intersects with the Libya conflict. And there have been instances of weapons flowing down to Boko Haram from various areas within Libya. So that sort of, it shows the impact that can, you know, we've talked about before, the impact in Mali, for example, of the Libyan conflict. And there have just been all sorts of after effects of that as well. So that's something that we're now dealing with in Nigeria.
All right. So in our final minute in this segment, before we go to the next segment, what would you say is sort of the overall summary takeaway on these four conflicts?
Yeah, so overall, I would say big takeaway is about 20 million people are currently facing famine, and UN says potentially need about 4.5 billion in emergency food aid, and it's the biggest crisis since World War II. Meanwhile, the Trump administration is cutting American aid contributions to both the UN and other agencies. Trump administration is getting rid of an emergency food aid program where we're actually buying from American farmers and then sending that food to help out people who are starving. Apparently that's not good enough anymore, even though Trump was trying to bring jobs here at home or whatever. So they're facing about a 40% cut. 1.5 billion is the proposal for fiscal year 2018 from about 2.6 billion in 2016. Meanwhile, in the intervening time there, the famines will have gotten worse. So that we're seeing a pretty severe cut from the Trump administration, and hopefully Congress will be able to ameliorate that. But people need to be pushing their representatives to make this a priority and not let, you know, the budget just roll through and get all these cuts through.
When we return in a moment, we're going to be switching gears to talk about another Trump administration decision, this time in the United States, regarding air traffic control. So please stick around from arsenalfordemocracy.com and WVUD. You're still listening to Arsenal for Democracy. I'm your host, Bill. Still in studio with me is Nate. We're going to talk now about air traffic control. So President Trump had a new proposal that rolled out last night and today, I guess. And we want to talk about what his proposal is and some of the background on air traffic control and the Air Traffic Controllers Union. So let's get into that. First of all, briefly, what's this specific proposal now here in 2017?
Yeah, I guess the large portion of it would be to spin off the actual air traffic control from the FAA. And this is part of his focus on infrastructure. I guess he's going around the country this week talking about the various ways he's going to invest in our infrastructure by privatizing all of it or something like that. I think that's going to be the large focus of it. So in this case, it's not so much, I guess, that they're fully privatizing like the FAA or anything like that, but there would be sort of a separate, more private program. They claim they're trying to, you know, increase innovation and efficiency and decrease wait times and things like that. So they were hauling that out today and is largely supported by a lot of the airlines, although I believe Delta opposed it. And we were just talking a little bit, Bill, about the reasons the Air Traffic Controllers Union would actually have to support it, because I guess they are supporting this effort. So it's about $10 billion a year are usually spent by the FAA on air traffic controller, and it's funded largely by user fees, and they're trying to develop the next generation of air traffic control, like reform, so using more updated technology, things like that. And I guess the claim would be that the government is not, you know, as efficient at creating these new technologies or whatnot. So that's the angle they're going with there.
Now, some time ago, historically, you know, air traffic controllers had a very, very powerful union and could control a lot of things because they're, you know, they're literally controlling the planes in the sky. So they're very critical. That gives them a lot of leverage. And in addition to that, and this remains true today, there are relatively few people who have the skill set. You can't just pull someone off of some other job and be like, you're an air traffic controller now. And so the relatively limited number of people who have that relevant skill set means that, again, there's a leverage situation there. But many people, when they think of air traffic control, especially if they're if they're a lefty person thinking of this, progressive liberal, that sort of thing, they might remember the situation in the early 1980s with Ronald Reagan. Briefly, background on that, what happened in the early 1980s?
Yeah, so the air traffic controllers went on strike in August 1981. And the context back then is, I mean, even back in the 80s, labor had a much more institutional power in American politics than it does now. And both the Republicans and Democrats had to respect that. And I believe actually the PATCO, which is the name of the union
at the time.
At the time, they had supported Reagan, actually, I believe, in the election. And as it comes out, they ended up striking for various, you know, conditions and things like that in the workplace. And Reagan threatened to fire the strikers if they didn't return within 48 hours of the walkout. And that when they did not, you know, we fired them. And this was a sort of a major, you know, turning point in his early presidency. As you know, Reagan was trying to make America great again as well. I mean, that was a slogan. So that is sort of, we're seeing sort of a parallel here between these two sort of arch conservative presidencies, both in the early era of the presidency.
And I think it's no accident. Yeah. You know, that Trump himself probably doesn't care one way or the other about air traffic control. It's not something he's ever thought about before, you know, yesterday, I'm sure, or whenever they put this in front of him. But the people around him do, right? The people around him, you know, Reince Priebus, that sort of type of person, they're Republicans who, you know, either were teenagers or became early, you know, were young adults, at the time that Reagan was ascendant, the very early period of the Reagan administration. That's the person they idolize. That's the person that they've built up in their heads way more than was, you know, matched in reality. That's the person that they're trying to emulate or finish the job. You know, we talked last week about how maybe Theresa May is trying to finish the job on some of the policies of Margaret Thatcher. Margaret Thatcher, also a strike breaker, like Reagan. This is something that a lot of people, pro and con, remember about Reagan, was that he fired all the air traffic controllers and decertified the union, PATCO, Professional Air Traffic Controllers Organization. There is, as we said, though, there is still a union. It's a new union that replaced that one, new back then. It's not new now. But that's the National Air Traffic Controllers Association, NATCA. And, as Nate said, they seem to be backing this, this proposal for privatization, which is fairly unusual. Most unions, tend to, you know, oppose privatization efforts if they're public employee unions. And their rationale, you can kind of see where they're coming from on this, because as a result of some of the stuff that happened with the Reagan showdown with the air traffic control back then in the 1980s, and as a result of some stuff that happened about a decade, well, more than a decade ago at this point, with the FAA under the George W. Bush administration and with Congress, basically part of the agreement that the way the new union was certified and set up is not only can they not support these, you know, dangerous illegal strikes or whatever, but they also have a lot less leverage formally in the process, because if they don't agree to a contract at a certain point, the FAA can just say, here's your new contract. We've just decided it by fiat, and you should have taken the deal that we offered you. And so that pretty much removes your leverage, right? And this speaks to a broader complexity that a lot of public employee unions do have, right? There's this tension when the government is both the employer and the negotiator slash, you know, broker mediator, is who is ultimately responsible for what and where is your duty lie? Is your duty to, you know, promote unionism and strong working families and that kind of thing? Or is your duty to reduce the fiduciary, you know, burdens and everything, you know, the financial strain of giving them these contracts? It gets more complicated than a private employer negotiating with a, you know, with private employees when it's public employers negotiating with public employees unions. And so NATCA seems to be making the argument that they feel that they could get a better deal if air traffic control, the function of air traffic control, were privatized or fully privatized, you know, taken away from the FAA, taken away from Congress, taken away from all of that. The government at best would just be kind of having some sort of, you know, normal mediating role in the way that they do, you know, NLRB, that kind of thing, for any, you know, private union and private employer. But they're thinking that they can get a better deal if they're just negotiating with, you know, with the businessmen at the top of whatever entity takes over this air traffic control, than they can if they're negotiating, you know, with, say, Congress slash the FAA, and you're dealing with all these total deficit hawks. Also, Nate, you were saying that they just feel it's been kind of a bumpy ride for the last few years with sort of financial instability and like the extreme seesawing. Well,
they cited the government shutdowns as well. So, I mean, that probably could play a little bit into their thinking. I guess some of the theory would be if they split it off into a private non-profit corporation, get the government out of the way, and then it'll be supported by user fees. And then the criticism of that would be, okay, this would actually then further sort of institutionalize these large airline sort of conglomerates or whatnot that would make it more difficult for smaller airlines. There's also sort of lurking in the background the possibility of automation. There's actually, I believe, an airport in Sweden that's moving into an automated sort of control tower type situation where there are people at computers at another airport looking at the various cameras and using that rather than having people actually in the tower. So a lot of these labor issues where we also have to think about, you know, what's going to happen when the machines start being able to take over. And also, I want to circle back to another thing we were just talking about in terms of Reagan and some of these Priebus types, the very people in the Reaganite cohort of the Republican Party, which is most of them. But Trump is a little bit different in the sense that he was very much pushing during the campaign as an economic nationalist. And actually, I believe in one of the debates against Hillary, talked about airports. And it sort of came out of left field for me. It's like, wait, why is he talking about airports all of a sudden? But he did emphasize he wanted to rebuild America's infrastructure and focused on airports as part of that, and is now going around the country, as I mentioned, talking about infrastructure. And that really speaks to the fact that the Democrats have let him capture that sort of issue by not talking about infrastructure as much and not having as more of a comprehensive plan that, or at least talking about that plan as much.
Right. Well, there was that episode that we did a few weeks ago that you weren't here for that, but I know you listened to it, about the blueprint that the Senate Democrats had released. So there are plans, but as you say, it's not
being
like
pushed out.
Yeah,
there
they did one or two press conferences and that was it, right? You know, they're not
right.
They're not,
Hillary
day
didn't,
after day,
didn't focus on that as well. If Hillary had returned fire on his claim about the airports and trains and ports aren't good enough, and come out there with her plan about, okay, here's how we're going to make America even better than Trump claims we're going to make it, then that would be one thing. But that was never really a focus of the campaign. So that's just, you're ceding ground to Trump on that tactic.
Yeah, I'm guessing that I still stand by that he probably hasn't thought that much about air traffic control specifically.
But he does fly
a lot.
Yeah, he flies around. He goes through these airports. I'm sure he's sort of scoffed around at various airports he sees in the U.S. and is probably super impressed with, you know, the ones he's going to in like Dubai or wherever, you know, he's flying around.
I wonder
to.
What he thinks of like LaGuardia. I know there's always discussions about, you know, LaGuardia not being a particularly good airport these days. You know, that's something New Yorkers talk a lot about. So I'm sure he's, you know, as a veteran New Yorker, he probably talks about
and
that.
He even gets
amount.
Probably gets to go in like the first class lounges and things like that. So, I mean, he's probably even comparatively better off than the rest of us.
Right. Yeah. So it's interesting that he's focusing on this, I guess. But, you know, despite what the union wants, I mean, generally, we stick with what the unions want in most cases. But as you know, there are a few unions that we do not side with. And in this case, I am very skeptical of this notion. I mean, maybe I haven't seen all the details yet, but I'm very, very, very skeptical of this idea of privatizing this function. And I don't know, you know, maybe that's how the unions are going to get a better deal for their people, but that's not necessarily what's best for the rest of the country. It also reminds me a bit of the credit rating agencies a little bit. You know, that they're not a public entity. They are privately funded by user fees and that sort of thing. You know, companies pay them like on Wall Street to provide these assessments, and that creates kind of warped incentives. And, you know, I don't think this is really what the proposal is here, but I had heard people kind of floating, like, you know, real advocates of the airlines perspective had been advocating like, well, maybe the airlines should directly take over, you know, the air traffic control functions. I mean, yikes. That sounds like a terrible idea.
That could lead to a different kind of crash, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, it would just be, I mean, it would be a very warped incentives, best case scenario.
Yeah, there was also a study released by Delta. And as I mentioned, Delta has been opposed to this privatization plan. They said that it could increase traveler fees by 20 to 29%. So just sort of imagine if your ticket costs all of a sudden went up by about 30%. I mean, that would be some serious results of this plan. So that's what we could see going forward.
All right. Well, Nate, thank you so much for joining me again on Arsenal for Democracy this week to talk about this air traffic control issue and also the various conflicts around the world that we talked about earlier.
Thanks a lot, Bill.
That's all the time we have this week. Tweet us your comments at AFDRadio or email AFDRadio@gmail.com. The show is available for download from ArsenalForDemocracy.com on Wednesdays. You can also hear it on the air in Delaware from 91.3 FM WVUD, WVUD HD1, and WVUD HD2 Newark every Wednesday night at 6 p.m. Eastern. You can get additional commentary at ArsenalForDemocracy.com daily, as well as links to articles discussed today. From my studio in Newton, Massachusetts, I'm Bill Humphrey, and I approve this message. Good night.